Hi, everyone. It's Laura Kanoy here. Just a note before we start. Over the holiday week, we're bringing you our top shows of 2018, as chosen by you, our listeners. Because these programs were recorded earlier, we can't take any new comments or questions. We hope you enjoy the show, and thanks for listening. From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Back in 1931, a Dartmouth College librarian named Nathaniel Goodrich came up with a magnificent obsession to hike to the summit of all of New Hampshire's mountains, reaching at least 4,000 feet. Soon, the Appalachian Mountain Club began promoting the idea, and it caught on. By the late 50s, there was an official list of qualifying peaks, a 4,000-footer club, an annual award ceremony, and so on. Today, more than 16,000 people and almost 300 dogs have completed the list, and some do far more, undertaking what's called the grid, meaning they hike every mountain in every month of the year. Today in The Exchange, the draw of the 4,000 footers. Join us with your questions, comments, and stories. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or call in 1-800-892-6477. We have two guests for the hour. Mike Dickerman is here, a hiking enthusiast and co-author of the AMC guidebook, The 4,000 Footers of the White Mountains. And Mike, nice to see you. Welcome back.
Thank you, Laura.
Also with us, Cheryl Sukers. She's author of 48 Peaks, Hiking and Healing in the White Mountains. And Cheryl, really nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
I'm delighted to be here.
So Cheryl, when and why did you come up with the idea that you had to do this?
Oh, Laura, it was back in 1998, and I was 48 years old and had just made a huge career transition from being in the world of business to deciding to pursue my bliss and write the novel I had wanted to write since I was a child, but it was not going well. And as I stared down 50, I thought, this is big trouble. I should know what I'm doing, and I really don't. So I wanted to find something that could give me a sense of success. It had to be hard so that if I could do it, it would really feel like an achievement. And in that way, maybe I could take the time I needed to learn the craft of writing, but also not feel like such a baby novelist who was flubbing around.
And there were other challenges, though, too, that kind of accelerated you on that path. You had a friend who got really sick, and then you got really sick. So there's a whole lot wrapped up in this story.
There is. I found that the more I hiked, the more reasons, as you say, I had to hike. My best friend and hiking partner died from ovarian cancer, and I wanted to honor her, and she had asked me to take her along. She insisted that I keep hiking so that it would keep me strong the way that I had kept her by going up to the mountains. And then once I had the trauma of breast cancer myself, I had even more reasons to go to heal the body, certainly, but also the mind and the spirit. You know, cancer does a number on you. And in addition, the White Mountains, the 4,000 footers, are just so amazing. There was enough space to absorb some of that grief over the loss of my best friend.
Well, and I know this is a theme that'll come up a lot this hour. It isn't just about putting the boots on and, you know, stomping on those rocks. It's about, there's a whole spiritual element to it, an element
Absolutely.
Of personal growth. And Mike, how about you? What do you think pulls people to this challenge of completing this list of 4,000 footers?
Boy, I think there's a lot of reasons. For some people, and it seems more and more these days, it's the goal-oriented adventures that they take, extreme sports, if you will, of doing that. For me personally, it was just I did a hike back in 1982, the moment stepping on the summit of Mount Osceola, first time I'd ever really gotten a great mountain views, and I was instantly hooked. Didn't know anything about the 4,000 footers at the time, but it was just a magnificent view from up there. And that just spurred me on, and one thing led to another. And before you know, you're hooked. You get obsessed with the whole numbers game. My older brother, who had hiked the 4,000 footers before me, he kept telling me over the winter, I think 82, 83, he said, oh, you should give it a try. And I slowly started picking away, and by 1984, I was living in the White Mountains, and then it was all over at that point.
You know, they really pulled you.
They really pulled me over. That's why I moved to New Hampshire. I was living in Vermont at the time, and the mountains just pulled me right over there, and I've been there ever since, basically.
What other stories do you hear from people who grab your book, Mike, and say, yeah, I'm going to do this? What are some of the other reasons that people tell you about?
I think for a lot of people, it's just accidental. You know, they start hiking, and they have a very similar situation for me where they get hooked. Just getting out there, and it's a challenge. It's for a lot of people. It's a mental and physical challenge. Just something to take on. I don't really hear a whole lot of other stories. That's really for, I think a lot of people accidentally get into the 4,000 footers. They don't start hiking with the intention of doing that. It's just a natural flow. You start the lower peaks. You discover the amazing views and the environment and the higher elevations of the state. And then you're hooked, and there's no going back at that point.
Well, and let's talk about the mountains themselves a little bit before we get into, you know, the list and the grid and the challenge and whether it encourages sometimes extreme behavior. But, you know, for people from out west, they might think 4,000 feet, like who cares, you know? I mean, what is it, Mike, that makes these mountains challenging?
Well, challenging is just, it's a terrain. Unlike
4,000 feet isn't that tall compared
to
some
not.
Other mountains.
A lot of it, I think, has to do with the way the trails were built originally. Unlike out west, where you have the 14,000 footers in Colorado, but it's all switchbacks usually going up mountains. Here, when they devised most of these trails back in the late 1800s and early 1900s, it was like, let's take the most direct route to the summit. Doesn't matter what's in our way, we're going to go straight to the top. and as a result, the trails are rockier, straight. They're tough. They're small, but they're tough. And I think as far as getting people into them, the mountains here have such an intimacy. You can really get to know the mountains because it's really – they're not spread out over the entire state. It's really kind of a relatively small area. So you get to know – you go one peak and you see – you might see 15 to 20 of the other peaks. Oh, I want to go over there. So
it's like a neighborhood almost.
It is like a neighborhood. And so I think there's that intimacy that hikers get with these mountains, which you're not going to get out west. I have a nephew who lives in Colorado, and it's just not the same out there.
You know, Cheryl, at one point in the book, and I laughed out loud when I read this part, your friend Ginny voices a pretty common complaint about White Mountains hiking. She says, I'm quoting here, I hate hikes like this. Where are the views, the sun, that feeling of being on top of the world? Ginny says, I feel suffocated by all these trees. Ginny, been there. And the trail, ridiculous rocks everywhere. I'm constantly stepping up or over one, and it just gets steeper. We never get a break. I laugh so hard because I have made that complaint myself hiking in the White Mountains. How common do you think, Cheryl, that feeling is that hiking in the Whites can be decidedly not fun?
I think it's incredibly common. And one has to find other things to enjoy because the footing is generally, I think it's safe to say, miserable.
To put it bluntly.
So in my case, and actually in Ginny's case, the more we hike together, you know, it's all about nature. For me, it's the wildflowers, it's the different textures and color of bark, the different lichen patterns, the bird song, the snakes, or even toads. I found myself getting into toads. I couldn't believe it. But it's all those moments strung together that make it such an incredible experience, and that feeling of being in the wild. Really, I learned that I had to take, even when I was with my friends or with my family, I had to take time out to hike by myself so that I could plug into the natural world around me, because we're made for that connection, really. And when we do that, or at least speaking for myself, when I do it, I feel as if I'm connected to something so much grander and larger and more wonderful than myself. And it's a thrill.
And all the challenges that you faced, you know, again, the broken wrist, the hurt knee, the cancer. So it helped you kind of unplug from all that worry.
And the pain.
And the pain.
Yes.
Although it's hard to imagine how hiking a 4,000-footer could help ease your pain. But, but Mike, you know, picking up on something that Cheryl said, you know, it helped her plug into the natural world, sort of forget her own problems. There are people who say, and we've heard from them on this show, this whole 4,000-footer challenge and completing the grid and doing all the mountains in winter and doing them all in, you know, X amount of time, that takes away from this more spiritual experience that Cheryl talks about, that this whole 4,000-footer list thing and complete it kind of turns it into a grocery list, you know, check it off, boom. What do you think?
I was anticipating this question. And there was a quote, back when the first peak bagging first became popular, back in the 60s and stuff, there was definitely some criticism, even amongst AMC members. And there was one particular writer who said, undesirable artificiality into the natural scenery of the mountains. The peak bagger said is obsessed with numbers games that demean the mountain experience. And I think you definitely hear that from people.
On the other hand, at least people are getting outside.
Exactly. For me personally, in this day and age where there's been such a hiking boom in the last 10 years, that detracts more for me because as I've gotten older, I don't like the crowds. So I don't hike weekends anymore. Forget the weekends. There's too many people for me. So that detracts a little bit. I'm not sure if I was hiking starting the 4,000 footers now that I would continue on with them because I don't like the numbers of people that are out there.
Well, go ahead.
Like I said, back when I was doing them back in the 1980s, it was a much different game, especially in the wintertime where there were so few hikers. But it's different out there now. So.
Well, and the AMC, we'll get into the history in a minute, but the AMC created this list.
Absolutely.
To get people out, to get them on those peaks. So you kind of have your own self to blame for that.
And one of the things, they wanted to actually disperse crowds from, at that point, people were concentrating on the Lafayette, you know, Franconia Ridge, Presidential Range peaks. One of the major reasons to develop the list was to get people away from those popular ridgelines and get them to outlying mountains as well. So now we're at the point where, okay, where can we send the hikers now? In my opinion, anyways, where do we send the hikers now that they've flooded the 4,000-footers? Where else can we send them? And I feel guilty of the book that we've done, The 4,000-Footers of the White Mountains, which came out in 2003. I mean, I sell more. We came out the first edition in 2003. We sold about 2,000 copies, I thought, the first year. And I sell just as many now, you know, 15 years later.
Wow. So you need to come up with another concept.
Yeah.
Maybe the 2,000-footers.
I definitely feel guilty for having this book out there now, somewhat. Although I think it's a great experience. Everyone should try to do them. But, you know, I have mixed feelings about it.
Well, don't feel guilty because it is good that people are getting out.
Absolutely.
So go ahead, Cheryl. You want to jump in there.
Oh, I was just going to say that I hear everything that Mike is saying. And I would say that in my experience, and granted, I was hiking, I finished the 4,000 footers in 2008, but of course, I've been back to several since. I almost never saw anyone. I mean, on a few of the peaks where it was, very popular, like Lincoln and Lafayette, you know, that was nonstop flow of people. But on the other ones, I could go a whole day without seeing more than one or two people.
Were you during the week, Cheryl, or were you on the weekends?
Because
some
both.
Of us can't do it during the week.
Yes, I was both. Sometimes, and it's true, it was always better when it wasn't the weekend in terms of seeing numbers of people. But often the friends that being a writer, I was more flexible. But others of my friends were not, and we had to do it on the weekend. But you know, even in 2008, our last peak, we were there for well over 10 hours and saw only one other person.
Wow, it's amazing. You know, to this point about this whole 4,000-footer challenge and it's drawing people out, and Mike says he feels a little bit guilty. Lewis comments on Facebook. He says, unfortunately, the mountains are not so quiet these days. Some, myself included, feel that social media is drawing many more to outdoor destinations like the Whites and especially the 48. While it's wonderful that so many are finding all that is beautiful about the mountains, the experience has been altered by the numbers of people and, in some cases, the overuse is hard on the environment. What to do, Lewis says. And you kind of touched on this, Mike, but what are your thoughts?
No, I agree. It,
on the what to do part.
Right, yeah. I don't know, how do you shut off the mountains? You really can't do that. The way the White Mountain National Forest exists and the trails exist, you can't do a permit system like they do up at Baxter State Park where it's limited access to the park. You can't do that in the White Mountains. So I'm not sure there is a way to really police that. It's definitely all the use of the trails. It definitely has an impact on the trails, drainage-wise. I don't know if there's an answer to it. I mean, certainly, Franconia Notch, we talked about it when I was here a month ago or so, with the hiker traffic. You know, it's not unusual to have 300 cars parked along the interstate on a weekend in Franconia Notch, people hiking. There was 250 cars last Saturday when I drove by. And they're trying to, you know, have shuttling people back and forth from Cannon Mountain. They've been doing that for the month, but again, last weekend, 250 cars. It's only going to get worse as we get into the fall foliage hiking season.
Go ahead, Cheryl.
Longer-term answer, more wilderness. Set aside more wilderness. I think that, you know, the benefit, I'm thrilled. I understand that it does change the experience, but I think that the more people who get out into nature and into the wild, the better for all of us. I think it you know, relieves stress, it calms the mind, it helps the body, it feeds the soul. And we need to protect these places and create more of them, not take them away.
Lots of emails coming in. And here's another comment on Facebook. This is from Doug, who says, I've been hiking in the White Mountains since the 60s, completed the list in 1966. Wow, Doug. Mm-hmm. I was recently comparing some photos from those early days, and it is shocking, Doug says, how heavy use has increased soil erosion. It is great to see so much people out there, but there is a cost to delegation of our trails. I'm not quite sure what he's trying to say there. Also, I think he means sort of deterioration of the trails, right? Also, we need to encourage people to spread out. For example, Doug says, the old bridle path up Lafayette is overrun, but the Greenleaf Trail is little used. So there's another job for you, Mike, in writing another book about lesser known trails.
Our guidebook actually lists every approach to all the 4,000 footers.
Yeah.
It's already in there. Again, people, because the bridle path is the best way to go up there, you have the best views, I can understand why people want to do that. But there are definitely other approaches. Skookumchuck Trail and the Greenleaf Trail are two great options to climbing Mount Lafayette, but they get probably one-tenth the use that the old bridle path does.
Well, a couple more emails. Here's one from Steve in Nottingham who says, good morning. I have climbed all 48 4,000 footers over 25 years with kids, careers, and geography delaying factors. Good for you, Steve. He says, what I want to call attention to is a special AMC patch if you climb all 48 when you are over 70 years old. I'm working on that now, Steve says. Challenging because I am slower than before, but that is my goal. I'm 75. And I've done 19 thus far. Good for you, Steve. And a little bit later in the hour, we will talk about older people approaching this, like Steve. Cheryl told us earlier she started well into middle age hiking the 4,000 footers. So we'll talk about that coming up. We're also going to hear from a gentleman, a well-known New Hampshire politician, who has completed what is called the grid. That's hiking all 48 peaks in every month of the year. Do the math. It's a lot of hiking, so we'll hear about that coming up in just a moment. And we'll keep taking your emails and calls. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook or Twitter is NHPR Exchange, and we'll be right back.
Every convention about how true crime stories usually unfold is upended.
That's why Bear Brook, the latest podcast from NHPR, has been downloaded more than a million times.
30 years ago this month, a mystery began.
It's the story of a decades-old cold case that's changing how murders will be investigated forever, reported by NHPR's own Jason Moon.
This story is not going to go the way you think it is.
Download it now or check it out at bearbrookpodcast.com.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, what's the attraction of New Hampshire's 4,000 footers? There are 48 of these peaks, and for some, they present an enticing challenge, not just to reach the summit of all 48, but to do it all year long. Coming up in just a moment, we will talk with one prominent New Hampshire politician who has completed what's called the grid. We'll hear about that in just a second. You can join us with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Our guests for the hour are Mike Dickerman, a hiking enthusiast and co-author of the AMC guidebook, The 4,000 Footers of the White Mountains. And Cheryl Sukers is here, author of 48 Peaks, Hiking and Healing in the White Mountains. And both of you, let's go now to State Senator and former Congressman Jeb Bradley of Wolfboro. He finished his grid a couple years ago. Senator Bradley, welcome to the exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Laura. How are you?
I'm fine. So when was that grid completion? Was it 2015, Senator Bradley?
I was in 2015. But, you know, having grown up in New Hampshire and my father was a hiker, I climbed Mount Washington for the first time when I was 11 years old, and I did some hiking with my father, and so, you know, I had hiked quite a few of the peaks before I actually bought my first AMC guide and realized there were 48 peaks, and then I set about, you know, over time completing the list, and it was a lot of fun.
So there's the list, and then there's the grid, Senator Bradley. So that's a lot of hiking. That's 48 peaks in every single month of the year, 576 total. Is that right? 576 summits
that's
over the course of
yeah.
a year.
Yeah.
So that's a lot. Why did you decide that this was something you needed to do?
Well, you know, at first, you sort of develop into it, I think. I decided after I was no longer a member of Congress that I wanted to hike in the winter. I just love being out in the winter. I've always skied, and I'm a snowboarder. And so it was kind of the next step. And hiking in the winter is easier because there's snow that covers all the rocks that
right.
you guys have been talking about, at least to a certain extent. And I enjoy the views. And so that was the first thing. And then, you know, You meet some incredible people when you go out and hike, and friendships get developed. And, you know, I actually met a couple of folks that were working on their grid. They were gracious enough to bring me along so I could complete hiking all 48 in the winter. And then I, you know, got proficient, and I just love hiking. And it really wasn't peak bagging to me. It was just, you know, you go hike, and you get out and you see the mountains. By the time you've done them 12 times each in different conditions and different weather, you have different experiences every time. And I've probably climbed most of them now at least 20 times.
Wow.
And it's still new.
So,
and I feel like everybody asks me, what's your favorite hike?
Yeah.
It's simple. The next one. And that's how I approach it. And, you know, I just have to say one thing, too, that, you know, to Mike, don't feel guilty. Do not feel guilty, because the way of the world is that people want to recreate more, and they want to appreciate, you know, the outdoors. And so by making the mountains, as you have in your book, more accessible to people, you're enabling them to be able to participate in the outdoors. And for, I think, Americans to have an environmental ethic and want to protect our environment, they have to experience our environment. And so I would, you know, I would just say that to Mike, who I think has done an incredible job of making the mountains accessible. And to the folks, and you've had some that have already called in, that, you know, complain about crowds and, you know, the trail conditions and things like that, I have a real easy solution. Become a trail maintainer. And each of the districts in the White Mountain National Forest has a volunteer coordinator. I am a trail maintainer. I have a trail on Mount Chikarawa that I maintain. It's, you know, it's kind of difficult work. You got to drag out a hoe and a shovel and a rake and you know,
Sam Bradley, if I could just jump in, because when
it's a great thing.
When I read about the grid, I thought, wow, okay, first of all, that's a physical challenge, but also the time challenge. I mean, you're a pretty busy person. You're a majority leader in the state Senate. You're active in all sorts of policy issues. So how did you even find time to do this much hiking in that 1 year?
Well, it's not a one-year thing. I did it over a long period of time, but I focused on it for 5 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I only pick good days to go. I mean, I don't go out, you know, and try to climb out Washington when you shouldn't climb out Washington. And you get, you know, the Fish and Game has a great website. The Mount Washington Observatory has a great website. New England Trail Conditions. So you can get a lot of information and pick and choose your days. And, you know, you got to relax at some point in time. Some people like playing golf and they go out every weekend. I like going out into the mountains.
So you don't have to do the grid in 1 year. I see.
No.
So I'm mistaken that way.
I think there's one person who has,
okay,
which is an incredible accomplishment.
Because
it takes about 350 hikes for me to do the grid. She was probably able to do it in 250 because she was like such a unbelievable athlete. But for, you know, an old geezer like me, you sort of plod along.
Well, how did doing this grid affect you physically, Senator Bradley? And if I might also ask personally, you know, our guests earlier talked about the spiritual nature of hiking these mountains. And I wonder if you want to talk about physical or spiritual transformations during this.
Physically, I mean, you're much stronger. And I people ask me, all right, how do you get in shape for hiking? So it's easy. Go hike. And pick easier trails first. That's where, you know, Mike's book and the AMC book is, like, so important. Because, you know, you shouldn't be going out to West Bond on your first hike when you're doing the 4,000 footers, or even Owl's Head, but Wambeck or Garfield or Tecumseh, you know, are really good places to go, or even some of the other trails that aren't 4,000 footers. They're beautiful places. Mount Crawford, for instance, one of my favorite. You know, it's a much shorter climb. Get in shape a little bit, walk in your neighborhood, then go out in the mountains, and that sort of gets you in shape. And then once you're in shape, then it's easier. But Mike's absolutely right. Hiking in the White Mountains, and I've hiked in a lot of different places in America and around the world, the White Mountains are as tough as it gets. I mean, I'd rather hike in Colorado at higher altitude because it's easier on my body. Once you've been in higher altitude for a few days, you acclimatize, your legs never get used to the tough trails in the White Mountains.
Those rocks. All right, Senator Bradley, we will let you go. Thank you very much for being with us.
And
we appreciate
your guests, become trail maintainers. We need them.
Okay. Thanks, Senator Bradley.
Thank you, Laura.
Take care. That's Jeb Bradley, Senate Majority Leader from Wolfboro. And as we heard, an avid hiker. He completed his first grid in 2015. You can join us with your questions and comments about the appeal, the draw, the pull of the 4,000 footers in New Hampshire's White Mountains. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Mike and Cheryl, since we just got off with Senator Bradley, Brian in Bartlett emails. He says, I recently met Senator Bradley in my driveway. I may not agree with him politically, but we do share a love of the whites. He told me of his grid success, and I recalled a time that I and two friends did a full moon White Mountain traverse. That's all the presidentials in one night, by far my most challenging and memorable hike. So both of you, Mike, maybe you first, let's talk about the way that people sort of slice and dice the 4,000 footers. Once they've sort of completed the list, as Cheryl did, there's other ways to do it that, you know, sort of allow you to have a different experience. And I wonder what your thoughts are about that.
Sure. First of all, I was trying to give you a note before. Jeb was the 49th person to finish the grid.
So not a lot of people have done this.
No, 80 people have done it so far. And
wow.
He finished in, I think, January 14,
or 2015.
2015, yeah. So kudos to him. He's a great guy and one of the best advocates for hiking in the White Mountains that I know of in the state, for sure. Yeah, there are all these extreme things, as the presidential traverse, which you just mentioned. Some of the people love to do the more and more trail runners now, running the trails, the famous Pemmi Horseshoe, which starts and ends in off the Kank Highway, Lincoln Woods. It encompasses all the Franconia Ridge, winds around basically around the Appalachian Trail to go over to Mount Garfield and the Twins and comes back around to the Bonds. It must be about 30 miles. People like to run that in a day, see how fast they can do it.
Is encouraging trail running, moonlight hiking, grid completion, hiking them all in winter. You and I sat down last time and talked a lot about rescues in the White Mountains. Mm-hmm. Is this encouraging people to take risks that will then put rescue teams at risk?
I don't think so. Most of the people that are doing that are experienced enough and have the gear. I think we see every week, you see in the stories.
Well,
twice
right.
A week.
Every there's Monday rescues. Morning, there's a story.
Exactly. But usually somebody's slipping and falling. Usually, maybe not. It doesn't matter whether you're experienced or not. You can fall. Anybody can fall on a trail, slip on a wet rock. That's where most of your rescues are. I suppose maybe in wintertime, there's try some of the more daring stuff where the weather conditions can be iffy. You can get caught in an unexpected snowstorm. I think there's more of an issue then, especially if you're by yourself. But a lot of these efforts like that, there might be joint supported by other people. There might be two or three people doing it at the same time. So I don't think there's quite that risk. I have good faith. I think most people that are in the mountains use their noggin. They know what they're doing. They have the right gear. I don't see the risk myself. I know you hear a lot of times from fishing game, they'll say people shouldn't be hiking alone, especially in the wintertime. I disagree with that because I think if you're going to go out there, you probably have the confidence, you know what you're doing. I know I did a lot of winter hiking by myself. I've never felt threatened or anything like that.
Well, it does soften out the rocks
talked
about earlier. Let's go to the phones, both of you. Mark is calling from Sandown. Hi, Mark. You're on the air. Welcome. Go ahead.
Oh, good morning. Well, I just wanted to share my experience. I finished my 4,000 footers in 2004, 36 of those with my two daughters, and it was a great bonding experience, and it taught them a lot of life lessons. But at the end of the 48, I decided I had enough climbing hard up, 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 and then hard down, 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 so I decided to hike across New Hampshire. And a lot of my friends have gone on to do the 64 and the 100, and those lists get you out and about. And I'm on a conservation commission in Sandown, and we push people into the woods, because if you don't use the woods, you don't vote for things that protect the woods or grow open space. And it's just a great avocation that doesn't cost a lot of money.
Yeah. Mark, thank you for calling. What do you think, Cheryl? You know, the list does get people out there and thinking about things they might not have thought about.
I think it's wonderful. I really do believe that people change when they're out in nature for a long period of time. That was certainly my experience and my friends and family's experience. And, you know, it also, of course, doesn't have to be the whites, related to your earlier question. I did, after I finished, I went on to become a co-leader with the AMC and led some hikes back in the 4,000 footers and took some friends. But also, I've gone to New Zealand to hike, and Poland and Canada and Switzerland. And they're just beautiful mountains everywhere. Of course, many, many places in the United States.
So it kind of inspired you to try hiking somewhere else beyond the 4,000 footers.
It absolutely did. I mean, once you fall in love, you know, it's like if you love to dance, you don't only dance on one dance floor, you find other places to dance.
You know, and in your book, Cheryl, The 48 Peaks, Hiking and Healing in the White Mountains, again, you really do talk about the hiking and the healing. You had a lot of physical challenges, including, of course, breast cancer. We received a similar inspiring story from a listener on our voicemail. Let's hear a little bit.
Hi, my name is Rachel. I'm from Jaffrey, New Hampshire. My trail name is actually Mouse. I owe the 48,000 footers credit to my health and my happiness and my wellness. I was diagnosed in 2017 with rheumatoid arthritis, and a lot of people think that that is a debilitating, like crippling disease, and it's not. Hiking actually helps with the disease as long as you're active and, you know, taking your medication correctly and following the advice of your doctor. You can lead a very productive and happy and healthy life, and I still hike upwards of like 10 miles a day and see the most amazing, beautiful things, and I owe it all to the 4,000 footers.
So again, Mike, you shouldn't feel guilty for getting for the book because she owes it all to 4,000 footers. Now, Mouse also told us that she decided to complete the list herself back in 2011 when she was misdiagnosed with a thyroid disease. I wonder how often you heard stories like this, Cheryl, as you were out there doing this list, not just your own story of, you know, injury and cancer, but other people's stories about, you know, this is more than just getting in shape. This is about something bigger.
One of the most amazing women that I ran into on the trail was named Ruth, and she's in my book as Ruth. And she had some kind of hip disorder, and she had a very difficult time hiking. But she said that when she hiked, it helped strengthen the muscles that held her hips in place. And so it was incredibly healing for her to do it, although she tended to have to hike by herself because she was so slow that most of people just didn't want to go with her. And she would do it by herself, and often she'd get lost, or she'd make an attempt on a mountain, and she couldn't do it that day. And she'd come back two or three times to finish a peak. And, you know, that kind of persistence and courage, it just kept me going, I'll say that. It was the wind under my wings. My hat is off to people like that.
I remember reading about her in the book. And let's talk a little bit more about this. You know, New Hampshire's an older demographic. Obviously, lots of young people come to hike the Whites from New Hampshire and elsewhere. But what about hiking the 4,000 footers as you get older? Cheryl, you first, but obviously you too, Mike. You know, those rocks will beat up your body, you know, knees or hips or whatever. You started when you were 47. So I just wonder what you think about the challenge of tackling this at middle age.
Well, I thought it was wonderful. I mean, it kept me from being sedentary. It kept me strong. I'm much stronger now at 67 than I would have been had I not hiked the 4,000 footers. I will say this, though. I think that as one ages, one has to be more careful to listen to the body. I started out not doing that and got some injuries as a result. But once I realized that, okay, you know, this troubled body will take me through, but on its own terms, then I did learn that, you know, I needed to take time off. I needed to get massage periodically, and I was fortunate that I could do that. And it becomes more of a partnership with the spirit and the will. I mean, I had a will that was sharp as a spike, but, I also had to deal with this body that had a number of issues.
Well, and at one point your husband says, quoting here, "Don't you think you should reevaluate the 48 mountain mission? Your first climb hurt your knee and sent you to physical therapy for 8 months. On the second one, lightning could have killed you, and the third one broke your wrist." So maybe a little bit later we'll talk about how you felt when he said that. Lots more emails, and Mike, I want to hear from you too on this question. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, so join us for that, Friday morning, live at 9. This hour, the pull of New Hampshire's 4,000 footers, and as you probably know, there are 48 of them, drawing hikers from all over. We're explaining some of the terms, hearing tales from the 4,000 footer club, from peak bagging to the list to completing the grid. What hiking these mountains means to people, both physically and spiritually. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Cheryl Sukers, author of 48 Peaks, Hiking and Healing in the White Mountains, and also Mike Dickerman, a hiking enthusiast and co-author of the guidebook, The 4,000 Footers of the White Mountains, published by Bondcliff Books of Littleton. And Mike, real quick, before we go back to our listeners, Cheryl was talking about how when you do this in middle age or older, especially starting out as she did at age 47, you have to kind of negotiate with your body a little bit more. And I'd love your thoughts on that as well.
Yeah, your best hike is hike at your own pace. I think that's really important. And it's really important as older you get. I used to do lead hikes for the North Country YMCA. Every week we would go out. And we did a lot of 4,000 footers. And I had a fella from, I can't think of his name now. He was from Milford area. He would come up once a week. He was approaching 70 years old at the time. And I was about 35 at the time. And
so you thought,
I was a much stronger hiker than him. And I could easily, you know, blow his doors off if I wanted to. But it was kind of nice to just amble along with him, let him go at his pace, let him dictate the terms of our hike. And it was such a great experience to hike with someone that age who just really appreciated the mountains. And I have a friend of mine from the Littleton area who hiked half the 4,000 footers when he was in his teenage years. He totally stopped hiking for 50 years.
50 years.
Picked
wow.
him up again in his late 60s and finished the second half of the peak when he was about 71 to 72.
Oh, that's amazing.
It's one of the longest stretches, I think, of anybody that's completed the list where they started and finished like 55 or 60 years later. So it was kind of neat that he went back and did that. After he retired, he had time. It was really inspiring to hear somebody do that at that age.
Let's go back to our listeners. And David on Facebook comments, my wife and I, along with our black lab, Lucy, completed the 48 in 2016. The bond and trust that we developed with our dog is by far our favorite memory. And there's a picture of Lucy, too. There's a lot of people who do the 4,000 footers with their dogs, Mike. I think almost 300 dogs have done it.
As of last April, I think it was 289 dogs had received their certificates for finishing the 4,000 footers. It's a bit of a controversial issue, A, because the dogs are going to go where their owners tell them to go, basically. And dogs can't, you know, the rubbing on their paws and stuff can have bad effects for dogs. It's a real issue in wintertime where the 4,000 footer club no longer recognizes anyone whose dog finishes in the winter because it's felt by committee members that it's probably not a safe endeavor
for a
dog.
Okay.
Again, they don't have any say in the matter. They're just going to go along because they like to be out there. But there have been some incidents over the years where dogs have gotten injured in the wintertime or, you know, as a result of hiking in the cold and the snow for hours on end. So it's a bit of an issue, but it's always fun at the annual awards ceremony in April, the AMC. It's held at schools. I think Exeter High School is the site now, but dogs aren't allowed in the school. So before they do the human presentation, they have an outdoor ceremony where all the dogs who have finished are recognized for their accomplishments outside the auditorium or outside the school. And that's been more popular as we've gone over years and years. I mean, right now I look at the last 10 years, an average of about 25 dogs finish the list every year as well.
Wow. So. Do you have a dog, Cheryl?
I did. She died a few years back, my dog Juniper. But she was a big hiker, even though she was not a big dog. She was a Bichon Frise, so little, tiny, white, curly-haired dog. But she was born in Derry, New Hampshire, and she was a hiking dog. She did seven of the 4,000 footers with me. Sometimes we had to carry her over rocks.
That's right. There's a story about the two of you almost getting hit by lightning or something
yes.
like that.
Well,
that's right.
Amazingly, yeah. she still trusted me after that hike. I wasn't sure she would, but she did. And she was always so much fun to have along.
Mike?
I want to mention, you know, we talk about the dogs, hiking stuff. And probably the most famous dog, and some people will think there's been this resurgence of interest in the 4,000 footers. And a lot of it, or part of it, that resurgence is from Atticus M. Finch, Tom Ryan's dog. He
That's
wrote the
right.
book, Following
yes.
Atticus.
Mm-hmm.
It was right after that book was published, which was a national bestseller, where the numbers started to almost explode instantly, 4,000 footer people climbing them. People first learned about the 4,000 footers through Atticus. He had a huge impact. That book and that dog had a huge impact, I think, on getting people into the White Mountains and hiking the forest.
Well, here's an email that we got before the show started from Nicola, who says, I'm hoping you can mention our Hike Safe program on today's show. It's a voluntary card that people can purchase each year, which exempts the holder from certain liability for repaying search and rescue costs. It's also good for those engaging in other types of outdoor recreation, such as paddling and cross-country skiing. The cost is $25 per person and $35 per family. So that's, I just wanted to put that out there as well. Do you guys have Hike Safe cards, both of you?
I don't have one.
I've never heard
of it.
You don't?
Really? Okay, well, there you go. After the show.
Yeah. I've actually only been hiking out a couple of times this year, so I haven't purchased one this year.
Okay, well, Nicola, there you go. Yeah. Thank you for mentioning it. Laura of Tilton also sent us an email. She says, I'm so happy to hear that today's show is discussing the 48 4,000 footers. As someone who lives in New Hampshire and enjoys all the beauty our state has to offer, Laura says, I feel blessed to be able to get lost in the woods of the Whites as often as I can. The AMC guide is a terrific resource that provides excellent detailed descriptions of the trails and services to provide insight for all levels of ability. Laura says, often I have encountered casual trail hikers who are ill-prepared and present a risk to themselves and others. There are some excellent web-based resources, too, which detail higher mountain summit forecasts, as well as current trail condition reports, which anyone who is venturing out should refer to before heading out. And Laura also mentions the hike safety card. So thanks to Laura and Nicola for mentioning that. Mm-hmm. And Matt in Raymond sent us an email. He says, when I was young and cleaning up my grandfather's house after he passed away, I found his AMC White Mountain Guide from 1940. The history in this book is amazing, Matt says. Seeing all the old trails and fold-out maps, including handwritten notes, was a very special discovery for me. I only have a few 4,000 footers under my belt, but I hope to complete them all someday. But every one I have completed so far has been with my grandfather's AMC guide in my pack. Wow, Matt, that's really cool. Thank you for the email. A couple people have emailed about hiking with children, and Sarah emailed us. She says, I'm about halfway through the 48 Peaks with my 11-year-old son. He has an appreciation for the nature and love of the outdoors that I think it is rare in a kid that age. We are creating lifelong memories on these hikes. When else do you get that much uninterrupted time with a kid that age? Sarah says, highly recommend. And Cheryl, you hiked with your family some. Now, I don't think they completed the 48 with you, but you brought your husband and daughter out.
I did. And my daughter, she would have started, I guess, when she was around 9. And I remember, you know, at that age, there were things that I had to do to make it more interesting for her. But she really got into salamanders or any kind of bug or anything like that. But I do remember sometimes where I created an orchestra. So she had a sound, and Larry, my husband, had a sound, and I had a sound. And we would just take a break, and I would conduct by pointing to them. And so we had games that we played to keep her going. And then by the time she was 11, she was definitely into it. And at 15, she did Mount Washington with me and some other mothers and daughters. And then her first year in college out in Colorado Springs, she hiked Pike's Peak, which is 15,000 some feet. And she did it with some friends overnight so that they could be at the top for sunrise. And it snowed on them unexpectedly, and I was just thrilled not to hear about that until it was all over, and I knew that she was back safely. But so hiking is definitely a pastime for her, too.
Yeah, I used to use M&Ms to help get my kids up the trail when they were little. So
bribes work.
That seemed to work pretty well. Jesse in the New Hampshire Climbing and Hiking Facebook group wants to know, will this be available in podcast format? And I want to let everybody know that The Exchange is always available in podcast format. Just go to nhpr.org, and our show is always available as a podcast, as are the other shows on New Hampshire Public Radio, including some that are largely in podcast form most of the time. So, Jesse, thank you for asking that question. I'm glad to answer you that, yes, we are available in podcast format. Absolutely. Let's take another call. This is Hilton in Tuftonboro. Hi, Hilton. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted I finished the list back in 1986. It took me 14 years. And I would highly recommend not hiking alone. I think that's a key rule of safety. Not just for that reason, but also it builds great relationships and creates experiences that you will treasure your whole life because you shared it with family members and friends. Even sometimes when there were challenges, it just it creates some great memories, and that's why I advise not to hike alone.
Yeah, sometimes you don't have a choice, though, Hilton, right? You're really slow, like that woman Ruth that Cheryl talked about. You're so slow that nobody wants to go with you. What do you think?
Yeah, I once took a young man, a teenager, who had some physical disabilities, and there was a group of six or seven of us, and yes, it did stretch out the day, having to help him up and down. But there again, was it worth it? Yeah, I think it was a great experience, and I learned a lot from it. And as long as you're prepared for it, that's the main thing, is to prepare to know what you've got coming and to get an early start. And then I think it's well worthwhile.
Well, Hilton, thank you so much for the call. And it's interesting, he says, get an early start, Mike. The last time you and I talked, we talked about hiking safely, search and rescue. And I remember asking the guests, what's the number one mistake that people make when they tackle the White Mountains? And one of the guests said, people start too late. Mm-hmm. So there you go, Hilton.
Absolutely. Yep.
And the other guest said, I was kind of surprised by this, but it makes sense. He said, people don't put a headlamp in their backpack.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. How many times we call it getting benighted on the trail?
Benighted, you know? Okay.
Yes, where you get caught up. It takes longer than you think. You start your way down the mountain. Darkness comes, especially this time of year where it gets darker a lot earlier than it did.
Yes, that's right.
2 months ago, and there's a lot of incidents like of that year-round, basically. But this time of year, especially because there's more people headed to the mountains in the fall to look at the fall foliage, they don't realize the conditions are way different up high, too. I mean, it can be 70 degrees at the base of Lafayette and 50 degrees and windy up on Lafayette. They get slowed down by the weather, the conditions, and don't realize it's dark. It's in the mountains by 7 o'clock, basically.
Yeah, I was struck by that last night. I was washing dishes, and I said, wait a minute, it's only 7:30, and it's dark already. This may be too commercial, Mike, but I wonder if somebody could, like, set up a table at some of those most popular trailheads and just sell headlamps. I mean,
not a bad idea, actually.
National Forest Service would probably have something to say about that. But that does seem to be a common problem. So thank you so much for that call, Hilton. Dan Sesney sent us an email, by the way. He's a White Mountains guy, author. We had him on this show just recently on his book, The White Mountain, about Mount Washington. And Dan says, for me, the connections to other outdoor lovers is the primary appeal of the Whites. I had the honor of being married atop Mount Lafayette, and it was such a spiritual experience, not only to have our closest friends and family with us, but dozens of strangers that happened to be up there taking part as well. Unforgettable connections. Thank you, Dan, for the email. Mike, in the 4,000 Footer Club, just to get some specifics out of the way, what are the sort of rules of the road or the trail, we should say? Like, you can't bike up some of these trails. You can't snowmobile. You can't ATV. That doesn't count.
You have to go with the existing conditions. Has to be all on foot, up and back. There's just I heard about last week. There's one road, Sawyer River Road, in the Crawford Notch area, which got damaged by a storm last year. Now it comes off of Route 302. From 302 to the trailhead, it's 2 miles. The trail starts 2 miles up the road, and it's a 5-mile walk to Kerrigan. Well, the road was closed by the Forest Service because of damage done. A friend of a friend took his bicycle from the 302 up to the trailhead, hiked it, came back down, took his bicycle back. That doesn't count because the existing conditions required him to walk those 2 miles. So I'm not sure who's going to have the heart to tell this person, but he's got to go back and do that all over again. But technically, he broke the rules which brings up a case, one of the most famous examples, Governor Milton Thompson, who finished the 4,000 footers, I think, back in 1967 or 68. Technically, he never finished them because in 1967, he did a hike up Mount Washington with a group, Paul Doherty, the famous fish and game officer, Charlie Berry, who a friend of mine from North Haver was with him. He hiked up Mount Washington. He took the train down.
Oh.
He took the Cog Railway down.
I read the AMC rules. That doesn't count.
That doesn't
count. You can't do that.
I'm not sure anybody had the nerve to tell him that it didn't count. But he finished the next year on Mount Flume. There was a big celebration, you know. But technically, he never finished the 4,000 fish, not legally, according to the club's rules. So that's the basic rules. Yeah, no mechanical contraptions you can use. You got to do it all by foot.
All right. So one of the other funny parts of this book, Cheryl, is when you and your friend Kate, who passed away, and she was part of your inspiration for doing this, you guys go to a meeting or something about climbing all the 4,000 footers, and one of you says, "So what do you get when you do this?" And they say, "A patch." And and you and Kate kind of go, "That's it? Yeah. A patch?" But what did you get from doing this? You know, you got a book, obviously, out of it, but you got so, so much more.
Oh, definitely. I developed a community of friends from hiking the 48. I had that very rewarding connection with nature that I'd mentioned. And, you know, as hard as they were, every time I'd get back to home in Massachusetts, I'd be filled up with energy and zest and just a willingness to go out and thoroughly enjoy life.
Yeah.
So much.
And helped you get through breast cancer. Absolutely. And the death of a friend and
all sorts of other
things. All right, both of you. We probably could have talked for another hour. I really appreciate both of you coming in. It was great to see you, Mike. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me again.
That's Mike Dickerman, hiking enthusiast, co-author of the guidebook, The 4,000 Footers of the White Mountains, published by Boncliff Books. And Cheryl Sukers, it was really good to meet you, too. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Laura.
Cheryl Sukers, author of 48 Peaks, Hiking and Healing in the White Mountains. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.